And we continue our annual series of interviews with party leaders. We're joined in studio now by the Sinn Féin leader, Mary Lou McDonald. Thanks for joining us. You're very welcome. If people vote for Sinn Féin, can they expect to get a Sinn Féin-led government?
Well, if people vote for Sinn Féin, they're very clearly voting for a change in government. A vote for Sinn Féin is a direct challenge to the monopoly that Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil have had on governance for almost a century now. And above all, a vote for Sinn Féin is a vote for a Republican programme for government. As regards who leads the government, that is all very much dependent on numbers. That's a reality. Whoever can muster a majority in the incoming Dáil and can secure enough votes within the Dáil assumes the office of Taoiseach.
And is that going to be you? Is it your ambition? Is it your expectation that you'll be a candidate for Taoiseach?
Well, of course, my ambition is, our ambition is, as I say, to deliver a Republican programme for government that deals with housing, with health, with many of the issues that we'll discuss now. And of course, I would wish to see a Republican-led government. And that's not just about personalities. It's not about my personal ambition.
Sure, it's about policies. This is,
it's about delivery for people, a lot of whom have been left behind time and again.
Okay, Paul Murphy of Rise said, if you, Mary Lou McDonald, came out and said clearly that you wouldn't support either Leo Varadkar or Micheál Martin, there is a chance here for us to radically break the cycle. He thinks a left-wing government is possible if and only if Sinn Féin rules out supporting Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael government.
Well, you know, I would say by way of response to that all things are possible with the support of the electorate. That's the key thing here. I've listened to a lot of what political figures and leaders have had to say over the last 2 weeks now and beyond. And, you know, there's a certain arrogance in the stance of many of them. Some of them think that they can just discount and ignore not just Sinn Féin, but the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who actually vote for us. And others are jumping ahead of themselves entirely. We have to have the election first. Mm. The first and most important conversation, David, is the conversation with the people and with the electorate. And just bear this in mind, on election day, every single vote is of equal value and equal weight, and the people are in charge when we go to the electorate.
But don't the people have a right to know what sort of government they're electing?
And
if people vote for you because they want change and end up with you putting Leo Varadkar and Micheál Martin back into the Taoiseach's office, they might have a right to feel aggrieved.
Well, no, I have said to, and I've said this consistently, as and when the election concludes and the people have had their say, I will talk to and I will listen to everybody. Because that's what grown-ups do. I'll speak to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. I'll also speak to Paul Murphy and to colleagues on the left. And my sole concern is not so much around the posturing or people beating their chests and saying who's in and who's out. I want us to sort out housing. I want people to have extra money in their pockets so they're not constantly stressing week in and month out. And that is actually our job. So a lot of this, you know, is rhetoric and hype because the election is underway. I'm very clear. I want a Republican programme for government. I want to make a real difference in people's lives because I happen to believe that people have a right to expect a decent life and it's our job to deliver it.
And you believe that you may be in a position to achieve that through being a junior partner in a coalition with either Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael?
Well, look, there's no secret in the fact that the differences between ourselves and Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are very significant. I mean, they're carbon copies of each other. We are the alternative. But of course, after the election, I will respect the mandate that's given to parties and I'll talk to people. But I want to be very clear that the objective here is to get a result for the people. The objective here is to land on solutions. This isn't some kind of career manoeuvre for me or for anybody else in Sinn Féin, I can assure you.
No, indeed. Now, you mentioned the fact that some parties want to exclude you from the coalition negotiations. Other party leaders have repeatedly brought up revelations from the Cash for Ash inquiry in the North, suggesting they show that Sinn Féin is different to other parties. And on the face of it, the evidence before that inquiry shows a Sinn Féin minister unable to take action in the public interest until he got approval from others in the party.
No, it doesn't, David. What this demonstrates, and I think this is really the political establishment desperately reaching for any pretext in which to count us out of government. The reality is that any sensible person who is in ministerial office will take advice. That's why ministers have special advisors.
The minister in question, Martin O'Mullar, wasn't seeking advice. He was requesting permission. Would you be content if I were to sign off the business plan on Wednesday afternoon?
What ministers will also do when they come from a political party is they will refer to the political party. But let me just be clear on this. Ministers in office, in the final analysis, make their own decisions. And not alone that, they have to stand by those decisions and they have to be accountable for those decisions. That's where the real accountability lies. But the facts are that, of course, people seek views. I doubt that there is a minister ever in office that hasn't sought counsel and advice. But when it comes to it, you make your own decisions and then you are accountable as a member of government for those decisions.
Okay, but Micheál Mullar, you say he was seeking advice from individuals. The individuals were named at the inquiry. They include Ted Howell, Padraig Wilson and Martin Lynch. I'm not familiar with any of those gentlemen. Are they experts on financial matters? Are they experts on renewable energy, as was the
David,
issue
can,
here?
Can I say to you that this election isn't about Martin O'Mullar or how he sought advice. This election is about creating a government that puts the people, the workers and families of this state first and foremost.
And we're going to get on to policy in a second, but your opponents are saying that they won't do business with you after the election in terms of a coalition because of this issue. They say it shows that other people...
Well, can I tell you that some of these opponents who are desperately concerned and making much of this are the same opponents who are out on golf courses with bankers and developers, and we know the consequences of those very toxic and cosy relationships. So I'll take no lecture from them. And I would say to you, people have an absolute entitlement to expect that any member of government stands up and is counted and is accountable for their decisions. Can I just say also that Fianna Fáil found it impossible to even hold their partners in government and Fine Gael to account. So that's the source of much of this this line and narrative, and it holds no credibility.
Okay, it's not just political opponents, though. The most senior civil servant in Martin O'Mullar's department at the time, David Stirling, said his minister had been unforthcoming and speculated that he may be acting under instruction. You're saying that's not the case?
That is completely not true, and there's no foundation or basis for that assertion. And any person who is in government is accountable in the final instance to the people, and of course they take responsibility for the decisions that they make.
And those individuals that were named in the inquiry as giving instruction, according to some of the evidence, you're saying that's not the case. That you would not be seeking permission from these gentlemen before you make
Listen,
decisions.
David,
yourself.
David, I think even my most bitter opponent would recognise and accept that I'm a person with a mind of my own, and I can assure you that I don't take instruction from anybody. I do, of course, and any sensible person will always seek out good advice and good counsel, but that's a world away from suggesting that you're under the influence of another person. Anybody who's in government, in fact, anybody who's in public life and elected to public office stands over their decision, their record, and they're accountable for it, and that's as it should be.
Okay, staying with cash rush just for a minute, the report is due out shortly. Mm-hmm. Do you expect Arlene Foster to be in a position to remain as First Minister, given that Martin McGuinness pulled out of government in Stormont just over three years ago, because of cash rush and Arlene Foster's role in it?
Well, I'm very glad that we have the power sharing government back up and running in the north. It was quite a task to land on a sustainable agreement, but we got there. I'm very pleased that is the case, and I know that everybody is entering this arrangement now to make it work on the basis of genuine power sharing. We will have to see what's in the report, David. There was an independent process to adjudicate on matters. They will come forward with their report and with their recommendations. But obviously, any person who has questions to answer arising from that report, including Arlene Foster, will have to answer those questions. I don't want to jump to conclusions. I do want to remind you of this, that at the time that power sharing got into such deep difficulties. There were fundamental issues around acknowledgement and inclusion and the basis for sustainable power sharing. And I'm very happy to report, although it took us much longer than I would have liked, that we have finally managed to land on an arrangement that can work, and it can work for every citizen, irrespective of their political perspective.
Okay. I don't think your manifesto isn't published yet, but you have said that a referendum on unity within 5 years of the next government is a priority. Is it a coalition red line for you?
I think it's a bottom line for all of us. I mean, the Good Friday Agreement provides for this referendum. Politics has changed right across the island. And the reality is that the discussion on reunification is underway. To a very great extent, the outgoing government buried its head in the sand. Our position is this. You know, people looked across the water and criticised correctly the government in London for not preparing the ground, or not having a full, frank and informed debate on Brexit. Let's just be sure that we don't walk down the same path here. I don't want us to have disorderly constitutional change. I believe there's a huge amount of work to be done. There's huge, huge opportunities that present themselves. I want us to maximise on that. So the preparation needs to begin now. In fact, it should already be underway. So certainly a forum or a citizens' assembly, or call it what you will, needs to be...
To lay the groundwork.
Well, yeah. Well, to do the groundwork. Mm. And that needs to come into being sooner rather than later, because Brexit is a game changer, as we all know. So let's be prepared for the change.
Okay, because obviously calling a border poll in the north, at least under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement, is entirely in the hands of the British Secretary of State.
Yes, and we've raised this matter consistently with the British government. They have not been helpful in that they haven't set out what they regard as the threshold that would trigger such an action. The reality is...
But what is the threshold in your view?
Well, I believe the threshold is when it is established that there is a basis for a majority to support such a proposition. Well, the unionist majority is gone in the north.
But there isn't a nationalist majority either.
Consistently in elections. A new type of politics, which has been very, very interesting, has emerged. I'm happy to say that we're an active participant in that. And yes, there's a discussion and a debate to be had. I firmly believe that reunification is the best idea for the future of this island. And so I want us to be prepared. And by the way, I want every citizen to have their say and their shout, including those for whom reunification would not be their first option. I know I've met people from the unionist community, even from loyalism, who now know that this is a discussion that needs to be had. And I think responsible government creates an orderly fashion for that to happen.
Okay, but at the moment, is there a basis for holding a border poll?
Well, at the moment, the priority is to have the forum and the assembly, because there's spade work to be done. And then I have set out that I believe a five-year window is the appropriate window for the calling of a referendum. And let this happen in a cordial and a civil way, an inclusive way. I want us to win that referendum. I want us to win it well. And I know from talking to people out on the ground, there's a huge appetite for change, a change of government here. But there's also a realisation that change is coming right across the island. And I think we need to embrace that.
If there were a united Ireland, would the RIC be commemorated? Would the RUC be commemorated?
Well, there are those who remember and commemorate both of those bodies. But the question that arose in the recent past was whether or not the Irish state should commemorate and give recognition to the RIC, the Blackened Hands and so on. And my answer to that is absolutely not.
Even in the 32 counties of Ireland?
I don't believe that we should celebrate those who actively fought against and who very cruelly put down moves to Irish freedom and democracy.
But sorry, the question was, in a 32 county Ireland, you'd still say no to that?
Yes, of course I would. I'm a believer in Irish freedom and democracy. I'm an Irish Republican. I'm a united Ireland. There's a different question, though, that you're raising. And that is, how do we accommodate people who don't share that view? Yeah. And what's the appropriate level of commemoration? What does that look like? That conversation needs to be had. Others can make their point, okay. But I am making mine. And I think it was actually outrageous that Fine Gael or any section of the government thought it appropriate that the black and tans be celebrated. Well, and I think they got their answer Irish people.
I think they would suggest that that wasn't exactly what was intended. But in any event, you want to bring the state pension back to 65 years. What's the immediate cost and what's the long-term cost in the terms of sustainability?
So the immediate cost is €368 million. The Social Insurance Fund is currently in surplus to the tune of €1.4 billion. So it's in rude good health. I do accept that there is there will always be a challenge to keep that fund buoyant. Let me say this. The idea that we would insist that working people work on past the age of 65 is, I believe, indecent. I think for people who have started work maybe at 17, 18, 19 years of age, they could be working on construction or in retail. They could be shift workers. You see, by the time they hit the age of 65, they've done their bit, they've paid their dues, and they've contributed to our society. So as a matter of principle, as a matter of decency, everybody must have the entitlement to their pension at the age of 65. And I notice that the other parties are reaching desperately to fudge this issue. They're talking about reviews. They're talking about alternative arrangements. In an advanced, civilised and a wealthy society, the least any worker, any citizen can expect is that at 65, they have the option to retire.
OK, but there are different ways to skin that particular cat. But there is a problem in terms of future sustainability, because over the next 40 years, the ratio of working age people to pensioners is predicted to fall from 4.5 to 1 to 2.3 to 1. So you have fewer people earning.
Let me make a suggestion. First of all, our demographics, by comparison with other places, are pretty good. That's the first thing to say. Secondly, can I just suggest this? Let's give a chance to our younger people. Let's give them the chance to have a roof over their head and to start families if they wish. And if you give a future for our younger people here on this island, the demographics, David, will take care of themselves. I have met countless younger people who have told me out on the hustings, they can't afford to rent. They don't believe they'll ever be in a position to buy their own home. And the knock-on consequences of that is they don't actually believe that they can put down roots here. They feel they have to go away. And so many of them saying, does this mean that I will ever really be in a position to start my own family if that's what they wish? And those that are sincerely concerned about our demographic profile, deal with that and give our younger people a real chance to build their life and to contribute here on this island.
Well, let's talk about that housing. And you're looking for a major increase in the number of houses being built, as indeed are other parties. The latest job skill bulletin from the National Training Agency, SULAS, says we have a shortage of skilled workers to do the construction, to do existing construction work, never mind expanded. So where are those workers going to come from in the short term?
Well, I believe that you have to put the horse before the cart. So you have to incentivise, you have to give those workers a reason to be here. And I think one of the best reasons for the construction workers, the tradespeople, the labourers to be here and seeking work here is the knowledge that there is a big programme of work underway and that they will have security of employment, that it's not just piecework. We are looking to deliver the single largest public housing programme that the state has ever seen. That is 20,000 public houses, so that's council housing. But it's also affordable housing for people who wish to purchase their own home and cost rental. It's ambitious, but it is absolutely doable. And it's the scale of ambition that we have to have if we're serious about dealing with the housing
crisis. Right, but are you looking to attract back immigrants? Are you looking to attract skilled immigrants from other parts of Europe?
Well, I would imagine that it'll be a mixture of both. I know myself that there's many people currently living away or working away. Their families might still be at home, but they're travelling to work, who would be very, very happy to have the opportunity here. The other item in our manifesto is on the issue of rental. There's 300,000 people renting across the state and they are being fleeced. They're being absolutely fleeced. We want to cut those rents and we want to freeze them. And that is doable. I've heard Fianna Fáil in their latest flip-flop. They fought us on the rent freeze. Then they said they were for it. Now they've changed their mind. This is not only doable, and constitutional. It's absolutely necessary.
Right. You've legal advice to that effect, yeah?
We do. Okay. And let me tell you, the legal advice that Fianna Fáil is quoting is partial and not convincing at all.
Health spending, you're looking to increase health spending by $3.3 billion a year with an extra 6,600 frontline staff. Fine Gael are talking about an extra $5 billion a year. Have you been outbid by Fine Gael?
This isn't a bidding war. This is about ensuring that we get the necessary resources, especially to the front line. Look, I'd be the first to acknowledge that there's a longer term piece of work that needs to be done on our health system. It's broken. It's inefficient. It's a confused mix of public and private. In the longer term, we need to build an Irish National Health Service. Sláinte Care, I think, gives us the platform for that in the south. The Bengoa process in the north. But in the immediacy of the here and now, we have a crisis in the trolley count. Mm. We have waiting lists. We have people who should be discharged from hospital, but who can't be because there aren't enough home care packages. And in the here and now, that's where the resource needs to go in the first instance.
Okay, one final question about your revenue raising plans, include higher taxes on bigger earners and large corporations. A big chunk of what you're talking about is an increase of just over 700 million euro in tax from capping the amount of intangible assets that multinational corporations can write off against their tax. Now, intangible assets, obviously, I had to go back to my Leaving Cert economics, but they're things like patents and intellectual property and everything. By definition, mobile. Why wouldn't multinational corporations say thanks but no thanks and move?
Well, I think you could advance that argument in any case. You know, you could say, well, you know, if you look at any of the sweetheart deals that the big lads have, that they'll simply throw their rattle out of the pram and go elsewhere. But you can't plan an economy or revenue raising or social spending on that basis. Actually, the person who initiated this proposal in terms of the intangible assets was Seamus Coffey from the Fiscal Council. So this isn't, you know, I'm not claiming it as uniquely our idea. He identified it as a huge gap. And by his analysis and ours, it is revenue foregone that should not be foregone, nor should the 2.5 billion euro of profits that the three banks are turning be left without paying a single cent, David, not one cent in tax. If people want to be worried and scandalised over any single thing, I would suggest that we should be worried and scandalised by that.
Mary Lou McDonald of Sinn Féin, thank you very much for joining us.